I just thought I'd try to be upbeat for once. People complain that I'm too gloomy. My usual habit is to refer those tiresome people to the Book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 7, verse 4. But just this once, I thought I'd accommodate them. The heart of the wise may indeed be in the house of mourning, but the hearts of us radio megastars are in the house of ratings, so everybody gets thrown a bone now and again. Well, another week on the campaign trail, only two more to go.
Hallelujah! 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 Hallelujah!
Let's start off this week with a quiz period, shall we? This is one of those quizzes where I give you a list of four numbers, and you have to match each number to its correct description. You ready? These numbers are all dollar amounts. A, 112. B, 605 million. C, 850 billion. D, 150,000. Okay, now you have to match those four numbers to the following four descriptions, which are, of course, in a different order. 1. Cost of Sarah Palin's campaign wardrobe. 2. The federal bailout for overleveraged banks. 3. The current balance in Barack Obama's campaign account. 4. The value of your 401k plan on election day. Go on, give it a try. I mean, boy, is Obama pulling in the money or what? Well, it's only to be expected. One of the great political turnarounds of the last few years has been that the Democrats, who your granddad told you were the party of the little guy, are now the party of the rich. The super-rich are, of course, solidly Democrat. You wouldn't catch Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, or the Hollywood star of your choice voting Republican. I mean, what if the servants were to find out? Nowadays, though, even the mildly rich are Democrats. The New York Times told us all about this on Tuesday in a curious little article headlined, "An Outpost in the Blue Sea of Brooklyn." The Times sent a reporter to Park Slope, which is a tony, gentrified, yuppified area of Brooklyn, New York, where a two-bedroom condo will set you back around $1 million. An actual house, somewhere in the range 5 to 10 million. To make your way down one of those streets in Park Slope, you need a machete to hack your way through the thickets of Obama signs. Well, the reporter from the Times found four of the old-time residents still there in Park Slope, left over from the pre-yuppie era. These folk had lived there since the 1960s, when, quote from the article, "most everyone on the block seemed to be Roman Catholic and have 6 or 8 children, supported by a paycheck from the fire department, the police department, or another city agency," end quote. Well, these four old-time working-class Catholic families were the only people in their block with McCain signs. The only working-class people, the only Republicans. Fortunately for them, the surrounding yuppies are too busy doing whatever it is that yuppies do to have time to break their windows or burn crosses on their lawns. You know they want to, though. I sympathize with these people, the Donahues, the Dixons, and the Olsons. We don't get the name of the fourth family. Of course, they're all in their 70s. Pretty soon, they'll be gone, and Park Slope will be uniformly blue. That is, of course, if New York City, without Wall Street to pay the bills, is still inhabited at that point. Every week belongs to somebody, and this week belonged to Joe Wurzelbacher, a.k.a. Joe the Plumber. You'll recall that Joe Wurzelbacher was playing football in his front yard with his son when Barack Obama stopped by. Joe told Barry he was getting ready to buy a company that makes $250,000 a year, and Obama's plan would tax him more. Obama reeled off his usual wonkish BS about how his tax credit's this and his health care credit that, yada yada blah blah, as if we don't all know perfectly well that we'll be taxed until we bleed by whoever the next president is to pay for the boomer entitlements. Then Obama said, quote, "It's not that I want to punish your success. I just want to make sure that everybody who is behind you, that they've got a chance at success too. And I think that when we spread the wealth around, it's good for everybody," end quote. In other words, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. Where does that come from? Oh, right. Das Kapital. Having flashed that bit of Marxist ankle at us, Wonder Boy scampered off out of there to another Beverly Hills fundraiser. Joe the Plumber probably figured he'd had his 15 minutes of fame and that was it. Wrong. Before he knew it, the Obamaroids were shifting through his garbage can, looking up his credit history, checking local police files. The full probe. Did you know that although Joe does indeed work as a plumber, he's not a licensed plumber? And that once he got over $1,000 behind on his income taxes. And, oh, listen to this, this tells you exactly what kind of lowlife this guy Joe is, and that once, in seventh grade, he forgot to feed his goldfish and it died. Now that just shows you what kind of creep it is that talks back to the Lord's anointed. By last weekend, Joe's mutilated corpse was being dragged around the walls of the city behind Obama's chariot while a howling mob of liberals threw rotten fruit at it. Serves him right for making Barack Obama look a fool. Anyone else who tries to stand in the way of history, a.k.a. the senator from Illinois, will get the same treatment. As to not paying income tax, well, here's a story from the Empire State about exactly that. The culprit here is not a plumber, though, licensed or otherwise. He's chief of staff to our Democratic governor, Dave Patterson. Charles O'Byrne is the chap's name, and being the governor's chief of staff is a very nice little earner. Current annual salary, $178,500, plus a big fat expense account. And, of course, endless opportunities to have dinner bought for you, or other favours done, by people who want the ear of a guy who has the governor's ear. Well, it turns out that our pal Charlie didn't file his income taxes for 5 years, 2001 to 2005. Now, it's true that that was before Charlie went to work for Dave in 2006, but still, it's a lapse of attention that needs explaining in someone as highly placed as that. It would be like, well, you know, perhaps like someone running for president who'd attended a racist anti-American church for 20 years without ever listening to a sermon. Anyway, Mr. O'Byrne wants you to know that there is a very good reason he didn't pay his taxes for 5 years. According to his attorney, he suffers from non-filer syndrome. Non-filer syndrome. That's a health problem, a form of mental illness that incapacitates the sufferer for purposes of tax filing. Non-filer syndrome. You'll find it in the American Psychiatric Association's diagnostic manual. Down there with non-sermon listener syndrome, non-acorn repudiator syndrome, and non-terrorist avoider syndrome. And then there's the other Joe, the one Barack Obama picked to add some gravitas to his ticket. Joe Biden made some news recently when he stated, twice, that Barack Obama will be tested by a major international crisis within the first 6 months of his presidency. Biden compared the potential test to that faced by JFK during the Cuban Missile Crisis, although he also hinted that he may have been referring to a financial meltdown. He suggested that it would be a deliberately created crisis designed by adversaries to, quote, test the mettle of this guy. It's hard to know what Joe has in mind. Note that he didn't specify a military or diplomatic crisis. He might have been thinking of some huge new fissure being opened up in the world trading and financial system. Reluctant as I am to take Joe Biden seriously on anything at all, I found these remarks a bit worrying. Bear in mind that both candidates are getting regular national security briefings now, probably containing material from the daily threat assessment briefings that the president gets. Joe is also chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, let's remember. He has all this stuff rattling around in his head, and it may have been at the front of his mind when he was speaking. It's all been quiet on the Western Front since 9/11, but there's no reason to suppose that will continue. So, get ready for a fun 2009. China invading Taiwan, Iran testing a nuke, Russia taking back the Ukraine, oil at $200 a barrel, who knows? Not to worry, though. With old Capability Joe by his side, President Obama will handle any crisis that comes along with the same cool good sense that he displayed in handling all the other crises he's faced in his life. Like, for example, and not forgetting. And here comes former Secretary of State and retired General Colin Powell, declaring his support for Barack Obama. Let's see. John McCain, career military background, left-of-center Republican, bags full of government experience. Colin Powell, career military background, left-of-center Republican, bags full of government experience. Made a four-star general by Ronald Reagan. Made head of the Joint Chiefs by Bush 41. Made Secretary of State by Bush 43. And then Barack Obama. No military background whatsoever. Far-left Democrat. Experienced at running a playgroup with a bunch of urban radicals and wheedling favours out of crooked property developers. Well, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? I mean, why would Powell not go for Obama? The suggestion that there might be some quality Obama has that John McCain doesn't have, some quality that Colin Powell finds irresistibly attractive, well, that's just nonsense. I mean, what quality could possibly be involved there? Perhaps we could ask Oprah Winfrey or Louis Farrakhan or any of the, 94% of black Americans who support Obama? There's some mysterious quality there, obviously, some shining uniqueness of character that the rest of us just haven't spotted yet. What could it possibly be? So, the odds are on President Obama. How scared should we be? Well, let's slice it up. There are two obvious things we might be scared about, the economy and defence. We could have another Great Depression, or we could start losing cities to rogue nukes. On the first, Obama doesn't scare me. Neither he nor President McCain would have much elbow room economically. Either one of them will be running a system seriously strapped for cash. The coming entitlements crisis and the continuing debt crisis will drive any president, as opposed to he driving them. Economically, events, dear boy, events will be in charge for a while. Defence-wise, I'm also quite blasé. Coming from the old world, where nations with ancient enmities and well-matched resources sit right next to each other, and you grow up listening to your parents and grandparents telling you about mass slaughter in trench warfare or city-flattening bomber raids, the United States seems wonderfully safe and remote. I'd hate to see us lose a city, and I hope the authorities can prevent it, although I privately doubt they can. Still, that wouldn't be the end of America, and we have sufficient firepower to inflict condign punishment on anyone involved. President Obama will be getting the Security Service's daily briefing and threat assessment reports. He'll soon figure out how much danger we're in. I'm not going to lose sleep over this. What really worries me about an Obama administration is its effect on our culture. There are an awful lot of slots to be filled in the federal bureaucracy, and President Obama will fill them with his cultural Marxist pals. Remember Bill Lan Lee? Remember Norma Cantu? Remember Deval Patrick? Remember Janet Reno? There will be a lot of those types setting agendas, issuing directives, prosecuting dissidents, pushing hate crime laws, imposing PC standards on speech and publishing and broadcasting. I'm a writer, so that is what I lose sleep over when I think about an Obama administration, that we shall lose key freedoms. Under that engaging smile, Barack Obama has the heart and soul of a totalitarian enforcer. The kind of people who have filled our colleges and universities up with speech codes and oppression studies and chief diversity officers and all the rest of the poisonous cant of soft, smiley-face totalitarianism. Barack Obama is totally on board with all of that. This won't be a free country anymore. That's what scares me about Obama. Okay, just a quick roundup of the rest of the news here. Crystal Gayle Mangum, the stripper whose unsubstantiated testimony launched the Duke LaCrosse case of 2006, has written a book. Title, The Last Dance for Grace. Amazon's offering it as a two-book discount deal with O.J. Simpson's long-awaited memoir, If I Did It. In fact, the original title for Crystal's book was If They Didn't Do It, but the publisher changed their minds on that. An item here on airport security. The European Union has postponed the introduction of X-ray body scanners for airport security on grounds of, quote, privacy and health. Now, why would anybody mind having their naked bodies displayed on a screen to one of those bored, unresponsive, 75 IQ airport security employees? Hard to figure. Over in Italy, or as we say here on Long Island, idly, a court has prevented a couple from naming their son Venerdì, which means Friday. In case you're wondering, it's a PC thing. The court said that Man Friday in Robinson Crusoe was a figure of, quote, subservience and inferiority. Well, I'm just glad to know that someone still reads classic literature. What happened to Ron Paul, readers keep asking me? Well, Ron hit his high point with that counter-rally in Minneapolis while the GOP convention was going on. Since then, Paulism has pretty much fallen apart. You can read the sad details in Dan Larison's piece in the October 20th issue of American Conservative. Dan points out correctly that Ron was the only candidate speaking out with a real critique of, and an alternative to, the Federal Reserve's stealth inflation policies. Everybody rolled their eyes and passed on by. And here we are with a world financial crisis. Ron, you can say, I told you so. And that's more than John McCain or Barack Obama can say. A seventh grader, Ashley Jones, down in New Smyrna Beach, Florida, wore a McCain Palin t-shirt to school and got called racist for her trouble. In the same general zone, Louis Dugid, a columnist for the Kansas City Star, had a frothing fit when he heard John McCain call Barack Obama a socialist. Socialist, frothed Mr. Dugid, is an ancient code word for black. Well, that would have been news to the old Communist Party of South Africa, who back in the 1920s used to march under banners saying, "Workers of the world, unite for a white South Africa." Yes, they really did. Oh, just one last thing. Could we please retire the phrase, "You betcha"? Not just for the sake of us Palin fans, but because I've heard it around 2,000 times too often now. Pat Buchanan just used it in a column. For goodness sake, it was cute for a week or two, but now it's way overdue for the cliché cemetery. Can it, please, Pat and everybody else? Not for Sarah's sake, Sarah can take care of herself, but just as a matter of linguistic hygiene. Thank you. Well, I think I covered all bases there. Joe the plumber, Sarah the clothes horse, Barack the beatific, Colin the contemptible, and John the clueless. That sucking sound you hear, to borrow a phrase from some previous candidate in some election long ago, that sucking sound is the sound of hope draining away from the Republican Party, as it drained away from Conservatives back when John McCain secured the nomination. Hope, as the old saying goes, hope makes a good breakfast, but a lousy supper. Well, it's getting close to supper time. Still, since I'm trying to be upbeat this week, I'm not going to diss hope. Matter of fact, earlier this week, I heard one of the loveliest expressions of hope ever to show up in Western culture. The aria Un Bel Dì from Madame Butterfly, sung by Patricia Rosette at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York City. I had to reach for my hanky. Un Bel Dì gets me every time. In case you don't know the story, Butterfly's husband sailed away 3 years ago, and she's expressing her faith that he will return one fine day. She sees it all in her mind's eye. A wisp of smoke on the horizon. His ship sailing into the harbour, its cannon booming a signal. Then he himself emerging from the crowd, coming up the hill to greet her. Oh boy, I'm misting up here just telling the story. Well, here is Renata Tebaldi to tell it properly. I'd tell you what happens to Butterfly's hopes, but that would spoil the upbeat mood that I've been at such pains to generate here. You can read all about it on Wikipedia. This is Derb the Blogger, signing off for Radio Derb. And here's the diva.